Nam ki jai. Vacharam ki jai. Navadipam ki jai. Jagannathasami ki jai. Yamunamai ki jai. Shrimati Lassidevi ki jai. Samaveda Bhakta Vrindi ki jai. Gaura Premananda Hari Hari Bol. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om Nagarati Vinandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshura Miditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So we're continuing with our verse-by-verse study of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. So we're reading the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The third chapter is entitled Karma Yoga. Now, Karma Yoga, just to reiterate what we learned already, Karma Yoga means to connect. Yoga means to connect. And to connect with Krishna through karma or work. The word karma is understood in different ways according to what's called the context of the word. Now, that's a complicated word for all of you. That means where you find the word. Sometimes the word karma can be understood to be a reaction to something. Like when someone gets in an accident, what do we say? That's your karma. But that's a very insensitive thing to say to someone. Please don't say it. You don't want to say that. You could think it, but don't say it. Okay? But anyway, so that's, sometimes karma means something that's actually a reaction to something. Sometimes it means a sinful activity. Sometimes it means a pious activity. Like the Karma Kanja section of the Vedas deals with how to be pious and advance materially to go to where? Where do you want to go when you advance materially? No, materially we're talking about. Heaven! Don't you all want to go to heaven? If you go to heaven before I do, just drill a hole and pull me through. You ever hear that before? So, heaven, in heaven, there's all these interesting things. You got the apsaras. Anybody here interested in apsaras? No, don't say. You got apsaras, the dancing girls and heavenly planets. You got the handsome guys, too, not only the beautiful girls. But the problem with the heavenly planets is what? Chine punye marcha lokam vishanti, that after your good karma runs out, guess what? You come down, right? And how do you know? What's the sign that your good karma is just about ready to run out? I'd say that. Your garland starts to fade. Uh-oh. I'm in trouble. So, sorry about that. So that's a sign that your good karma is running out when you're in the heavenly planets. In the earth planet, the garland is always fading. In the heavenly planets, the garlands don't fade. Your skin doesn't get wrinkles. No problem, no doctors until it's time to go. You know, just like that. Everything's going very well, and all of a sudden, boom, you're back here. Shine punya marcha lokam bishanti. So generally, so that's the meaning of the Karma Kanja section, to go up to the heavenly planets. So anyway, so the word karma in Karma Yoga means the work, just work, plain old work. And so Karma Yoga means the work that connects you to Krishna. And there's another word, there's Karma Bandhana. That means the work that what? Binds you to the material world. What would be some examples of some work that binds you to the material world? Anyone have an example?
Intoxication.
Gambling. Illicit sex. Meat eating. Video games. Oh, sorry about that. Sorry if I offended anyone. It binds you. Anything that's not connected to Krishna binds you because it has attached to it three different things. What are the three different things? Goodness, passion, and ignorance. You know, you can be bound by the mode of goodness. Let's say You like to go sightseeing. Let's say next summer I decide to go to see the icebergs in Alaska. You know, the beautiful ice cubes. You ever heard of that before? You know, people take cruises. They spend $10,000 to $20,000 or $30,000 to take these cruises. So that's like, it's almost like a mode of goodness. Of course, I'm not saying what they eat on the cruise. That's a different subject matter. That's in the mode of ignorance. But anyway, so just seeing nice sights. So, but you become bound by the mode of goodness. Become bound with a sense, as Krishna says in the Gita, you become attached to a sense of happiness. Everything's going my way, zippity-doo-da, it's a beautiful day. You ever heard of that before? No. And in the mode of passion, you become bound by the desire to acquire more, and in ignorance, you become bound just with gross sensual enjoyment. So there's karma bandhana, karma kanda, and karma yoga. So karma yoga is the activity that's connected to Krishna, and that's the topic of this chapter, and now we'll get on to the Bhagavad Gita itself. So we'll start by reading text 28. So who can, any volunteers here? Who knows how to read?
One who is in knowledge of the absolute truth, O mighty Am, does not engage himself in the senses and sense verification, knowing well the differences between the work in devotion and work for fruitive results.
So here's the person in knowledge, a self-realized person, and actually the explanations we have in the slideshow were taken also from Srila Prabhupada's purports. So we're integrating the knowledge in the purports with the knowledge that's being presented in the verses. So the self-realized person understands this is not my place, this world. As Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, this is not a place for a gentleman, this place. This is a prison house. Just like a prisoner, hopefully, thinks, I don't really belong in this prison, I should become an honest person. So in the same way, a self-realized person realizes, this is the prison, and I should get out, and there's no escape, actually, but get out in a legal way. So that self-realized person performs his duty to please Krishna, and basically a self-realized person has no desires that he has to fulfill, except the desire to please Krishna. That's a pure devotee. And he has full faith in Krishna. So this is a complete, absolute, pure person is being described here. Now, on the other hand, we'll talk about the people who are the opposite. 180 degrees opposite. So text 29. So the ignorant person thinks, you know, in other words, I'm the doer. There's no other cause other than my actions. I create my good fortune. I'm a self-made man. I pull myself up by my bootstraps. I don't think you know what that is. But that's an old saying in America. And he just gets bewildered by all of his different desires. But he performs his self-made duty, but his whole goal is to enjoy his senses, because he thinks there's nothing more. There's nothing more. What do they say? The Epicurean says, eat, drink, and what? For? Tomorrow you may die. And in India, there's an Epicurean. His name is Charvaka Muni. What did he say? Anyone know the quote from Charvaka Muni? Beg, borrow, steal, get yourself some ghee. So that's a Vedic way of trying to enjoy the world. Get yourself ghee, put it on all your food, and you'll enjoy life in that way. Because why do we say ghee? Because ghee is like a heavenly taste. In the heavenly planets, they don't eat food cooked in margarine or corn oil, what to speak of canola oil. Which is called canola oil because it's a GMO oil that was made in Canada. Canada oil, canola oil. Just to let you know, that's completely GMO. Everyone's thinking, healthy, healthy, healthy. But in the spiritual world, in the heavenly planets, everything's cooked in ghee. In fact, there was one romance that's talked about in the Bhagavatam between Pururva and Urvasi. And she made the precondition for their marriage, one of the preconditions, in addition to other preconditions, that she would never be given anything that was not cooked in ghee. So ghee is considered very, very high class. And you perform fire sacrifices with ghee. You don't perform it with anything else. And it's the silver beak cows, the desire cows from the heavenly planets and the spiritual world produce unlimited ghee. So, anyway, let's go on to text 30. So this is the description of pure devotional service. And it's above all the ritualistic religions for sense gratification or even the dutiful work for purification. And here are the qualities of success when one reaches the pure devotional platform. Text 31. So, three things. Be attached to your duty for Krishna. Have faith. As Krishna says later in the Gita, Ashradana purucha dharma shasha paramtapa aprapyamam nivartante mrityu samsaravartmani. Those who don't have faith, they return to birth and death in this material world. And also he says, for the doubting soul, there's happiness neither in this world nor in the next. And here's the big one, envy. To become free from envy, because the source of envy that we have towards each other or towards other living entities is based on our envy towards Krishna. Because Krishna is Ishwara, Ishwaroham, he's the supreme controller. But we are also thinking Ishwaroham, aham bhogi, siddhoham, balavan sukhi. I'm perfect, powerful, happy. I'm the Lord of all that I survey. I'm a self-made man. So here's the qualities of success. If you want to graduate in Krishna consciousness, get your diploma, you know, wear your robes, then that's how you do it. So all these devotees, they were graduating, they forgot to put their tilak on, though. Unfortunately. Okay. And then the qualities of failure are, this is actually text 32. It's mislabeled right here. Who wants to read text 32?
Disregard his teachings and do not follow them regularly are to be considered bare of all knowledge, befooled, and ruined in their endeavors to perfection.
Now they may get some material goals fulfilled because they have some good karma stored up. But then what happens is the bad karma comes. So you have a store, if you're not Krishna conscious, God conscious, spiritually conscious, you have a store of good karma and bad karma. And it's all waiting for you. Like it's lying there as seed, or it's almost fructified, or it's almost mature, and some of it is mature. Like if you have legal problems, health problems, whatever, if you're not Krishna conscious, that's an indication of the karma. So this is what's going to happen to you ultimately. You're going to crash. Yeah, we all crash, isn't it? Mrityu sarvaharaschaham, Krishna says. Krishna says, I make everybody crash. I'm all-devouring death. Mrityu sarvaharaschaham. And kalavasmi, he's time, which causes that. So in text 33...
Repression.
So, in other words, it's not enough to know these things. That's theoretical knowledge. Even though even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. So, even if we know this, we're not the body, we're transcendental to this world, still we have certain bodily identification. There's a certain percentage that we're identifying with the body. So we have to act in terms of our psychophysical nature to serve Krishna. And that psychophysical nature is ascertained either by the spiritual master, by other devotees, or even introspectively by yourself to understand how to engage yourself and dovetail your activities in Krishna consciousness. And when you're perfectly purified, then you no longer have any material needs. You have examples of personalities like the six Goswamis of Vrindavan who could live on one pat of butter every 2 days and sleep like a half hour, not sleep, rest, a half hour at night. Who here can sleep a half hour at night and be happy? No one. No one here in this room, I don't think. So self-realized devotees, I mean perfectly pure Nitya Siddha devotees, can do things that are materially impossible because there's no more material needs. They're getting their energy, intelligence, and everything from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in the meantime, before we reach that stage, we have to understand our material situation, and that's Varnashram. So Krishna here prescribes in text 34, which someone will read.
Attraction and impulsion to sense objects are felt by embodied beings, but one should not fall under the control of senses and sense objects because they are stumbling blocks on the path of self-realization.
In other words, rather than thinking negatively about sense objects or engaging the senses with the sense objects, one should understand what they need psychologically, physically, spiritually, in order to be balanced in Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada gives the example here of salt. Like if you don't put any salt in your food, it's pretty tasteless. And if you put too much, you'll have high blood pressure. It'll make you sick. So there has to be some salt put in, so some sense gratification, but it's regulated. Like in marriage, the regulated sense gratification or the interaction between husband and wife is prescribed in the Vedic literatures. Or our eating process, we have regulated sense gratification in eating. What's that called? Prasadam. Because one who eats something without offering to Krishna, what is he eating?
Sin.
What does it mean, sin? That means he's getting bad karma. Because even if you eat a broccoli, the poor broccoli died for your sins. Anyway, sorry about that. But even if you're eating a broccoli, you're cutting it, this poor broccoli. And a broccoli, I know it can't experience pain as much as you and I can. Obviously, if you cut me down, I'd be writhing in pain. But there is scientific evidence that even plants, they experience sensations. Even they like certain types of music. Like there are experiments that if you play rock and roll, you all know what rock and roll, anyway, modern music to the plants don't grow. They just remain stunted. And if you play Hare Krishna music, the plants grow sky high. So there is some consciousness there, although it's very, very limited. So getting back to the point, so even if you eat broccoli and you don't offer it to Krishna, then you have some reaction there. And you can't avoid doing something to other living entities just because you live. You can't avoid it. If you breathe, you're affecting living entities. If you start your car, thousands, millions of living entities get cremated, you know, microbes. Whatever you do, if you cook. So there's no way you can avoid it. Therefore, if you offer to Krishna, Krishna frees you from those reactions. Small as they may be, but still there are some reactions. So we have an authorized, regulated sense, sense enjoyment in prasadam, other things in Krishna consciousness. There can be some recreation too. It's not that devotee of Krishna has to sit all day long chanting Om or Hare Krishna or something like that. You can play a little sporting activities, get some recreation, like that. Whatever is necessary, so it's regulated. So that's text 34. And 35, who's going to read 35?
It is far better to discharge one's prescribed duties, even though faultily, than another duty's perfectly. Destruction in the course of performing one's own duty is better than engaging in another's duty. For to follow another's path is dangerous.
Now, let's unpack that. You know, destruction in performing another's duty is destruction of the course, I'm sorry, performing your own duty is better than engaging in others' duty? Wow. That's a heavy statement, isn't it? The reason for that, there's a very good reason for that, as which Krishna brings out later on, is that you're going to be forced to do something according to your nature, because your duty is ascertained according to what your psychophysical nature is. We're talking about varnashram here. So let's say, I mean, let's give an example that, or let's say I'm a sannyasi. I am a sannyasi, or at least that's the role I have. And so I have certain duties proscribed and prescribed. Proscribed means things I can't do. Prescribed means things I can do. All right, so let's say I want to do something that's proscribed. In other words, prohibited. I want to do business. So I say to Rishikesh, you know, let's invest in the stock market. You know, I have this really nice scheme like that. So that creates problems. The problem, even if I'm successful, let's say I make a lot of money in the stock market. You know, Rishikesh and I are able to build a new temple across the street. We're really ecstatic about it. Well, one problem is that my mind will be absorbed in the mode of passion. And then I will not be executing or showing the right example or guiding people. It will create a social dysfunction, which is really important to understand that all of us are responsible for other people in society. You know, normally in America, we think, you know, it's the me culture. I'm not criticizing American culture, but I was born here, I can say that. So it's a me culture, and you don't consider the effects of your activities on other people. I mean, that's one reason why you have so much divorce. That's one reason for so many problems in society. Whereas in a traditional society, you see yourself, society first, and yourself as serving the society, whereas in America, you see yourself first as society is serving you. It's really the opposite. So, in other words, we perform our duties for the sake of society. Because if society becomes disturbed or the social order becomes disturbed, then you have illicit life going on. People get very, very confused. And there won't be an emphasis on spiritual life at that point. So in other words, if I change my duty, if I do something that's proscribed, prohibited, it creates problems for other people. So I should be thinking about other people. Also, I should be thinking about myself. My own spiritual life. So, anyway, so that's one example that if one does another's duty, it creates problems. So you can find many, many other examples which we don't have time to talk about. So we stick to our specific duty for the sake of others and for the sake of ourselves, and we understand what our duties are, both spiritual and material, being guided by the senior members of society, spiritual duties by the spiritual master, and material duties the spiritual master and other senior people in society can advise us on those material duties. And what's described here is what's medicine for one patient is poison for another. Like for someone who's married, let them invest in the stock market if they can make money. But not a sannyasi. It's just not appropriate. You know, so there's a division of duties like that. Very, very important point Krishna is making. So Krishna is saying that we perform this nishkama karma yoga, which means to serve Krishna in our activities without desire, regulate our senses, and life is so much easier. There's problems, but at least you know you're in the right path and you know you're making spiritual progress and you know you're going to win at the end. It's like a war. Yes, spiritual life is sometimes like a war, and there's many battles in the war, but you're guaranteed that you're going to win the war. It was like World War II. There were many battles, the Battle of the Bulge and other battles like that. And ultimately, the good guys won. So the important thing is what happens at the end, isn't it? Mm-hmm. In between so many things may happen. But at the end, if you win the war, you got it. And then everyone will call you a hero. You get a bronze medal or a whatever. Okay. And so, I'm not in a bad mood. Don't worry about it. So, here we're going to talk about how one is forced to act or think or manifest his consciousness by different forces in this world. So danger, don't worry. In other words, beware of lust and anger, which can deviate any of us. And so now we're going to learn about lust and anger. First of all, let's hear about lust. This looks like a devotee, but his seeker's in the wrong place. Two seekers on the top. So, all right, so who's going to read text 36?
Arjuna said, O descendant of Vishnu, by what is one compelled of sinful acts, well, unwillingly as if engaged by force?
So this is Arjuna's question, you know, why did the devil make me do it? You ever hear that expression before? That's a common American expression. That someone, it's a big excuse, you know. Why did you do that? The devil. You know, then it's not my fault. Don't blame me. That devil is out there, you know. And he's making me do all sorts of things I don't want to do. So, Hare Krishna. So, we devotees don't say devil so much. We say what? Maya. Maya force. I was in Maya. So there's different ways of saying the devil made me do it in different cultures. It was Maya. Krishna says Maya. Mama Maya Duratriya. Maya is very strong. How do you expect me to overcome it? You know, don't blame me. So there was an interesting story told by Prabhupada one time. There was a king who asked the sage, why is Maya so strong? So the sage, he ran up to a pillar, he embraced the pillar, it's interesting, and what did he say?
Let me go,
let me go! So, Maya is so strong because we accept Maya. We don't have to, we can accept Krishna. There's two things, Krishna and Maya. And Maya is defined as the absence of Krishna. Krishna Surya Sam Maya Hoy Andhakar. Just like, darkness is what? Absence of light. It's not a real substance. I mean, as much as you like, you know, you see all these mystery movies or monster movies, it was darkness who came. But actually, it just means there's no light there. That's all. The sunshine, when the sun goes down, or there's clouds, it'll become dark. Because the sun is not there. Krishna Surya Sama. Krishna is the sun. Maya Hai Andhakar. In other words, this is the motto of the Back to Godhead magazine. Krishna is the sun. Wherever there's Krishna, there's no nescience. Nescience is the same as Maya. Okay, so Arjuna is saying, you know, what is one for? How is one is forced to act? And then Krishna answers in text 37, what?
The Supreme Personality of Godhead say it is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mold of fashion and later transferred into worth and
wrath,
and which is the all
devouring
sinful enemy of this world.
So here's our friend, wrath. So, did you like that? Children like that? Do you ever see anyone who looks like that? Yeah. When people get angry, people look like that, isn't it? It's a photograph we took of someone I know. So, of course, we find, described by Krishna in the Gita, that when, this second chapter, when one contemplates sense objects, one gets attached. Jayato vishayak putam sangasteshu bhajayate. We read about that earlier in this whole discussion. Sangat sanjayate kama. And then one gets lusty, kama krodha bijayate. And then krodha comes out. Krodha means anger. And that's unsatisfied desires. Unsatisfied desires. I mean, I just saw that. I just came back today from Philadelphia. We had a preaching program in Philadelphia. So I was in the airport. And some people, they had to take a later flight. And they were getting so angry. You know, just because it was an hour, not that they lost anything or anyone died or anything like that. They were a little inconvenienced. And this, the poor person sitting behind the desk, you know, the agent, He was at the brunt of everyone's anger. And there was this lady just yelling at him, "Don't you understand? I have to waste 2 hours here." And so, of course, they're trained in the airport to deal with that. One time I even saw a man reach over the counter and grab the agent by the neck because the plane was delayed a little bit. So anger, frustrated lust. So that's the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world, this anger and lust. And let's read how the living entity is covered by different degrees of this lust in the next text, text 38.
As fire is covered by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust, or as the embryo is covered by the womb, the living entity is similarly covered by different degrees of this lust.
So you see it? There's the embryo of the moon, in the womb, and then the fire, the smoke, and the dust, and then, oh my God. That's what happens when you're too much involved in lusty affairs. You take birth as a tree.
Is this a real picture?
I'm not sure. I found it. If it is, it's definitely a human being who was too lusty in their last life. But anyway, we saw it on the internet, so it looked interesting. So that's what happens. Tree body. Now, what happened with Mani Griva Nalakuvra? Trees. Everybody knows that story? Famous story. They were so lusty, they were at a rainbow festival. You know what a rainbow festival is? That's in America, they have these rainbow festivals where people take off their clothes. And they jump in the mud with pigs and everything like that. We have some devotees here who went to them in the 1960s. You know, and there's, anyway, that was Woodstock. Anyone's heard of that? Yeah. Anyway, so what they did at the Rainbow Fest, anyway, so the Rainbow Fest, so these two personalities, they were from the heavenly planets, and they were bathing in the Mandakini Ganges, and they were naked, and they were with ladies there. And Narada Muni comes by, and, you know, some sannyasi comes by. I mean, you don't keep bathing in the river naked, do you? Not a good idea. Although, you know, one time I went to one of these rainbow festivals, last time I go, and people were bathing naked in the river right in front of me. So anyway, so Narada Muni came by, and the girls had more intelligence than the boys. They got out and covered themselves. But Mani Griva and Nalakuvra, they just said, "Hi, Narda," exposing themselves to Narada Muni. "How are you doing, Maharaj?" And can you imagine that? If that's how intoxicated they were, can you imagine? You know, you go up to some devotee. Anyway, so don't picture that in your mind. So Narada Muni said, "You're acting in the mode of ignorance. You should become like trees." And Prabhupada said that, you know, people too much involved in lusty affairs, they become trees in the next life. And they became trees. But fortunately, they became trees in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj. And so who saved them later on?
Krishna.
Krishna, yeah, Damodar. And what did he do? He pulled them down. And then they saw Krishna, and then they became liberated. So if you have to do something like that, do it in front of a sannyasi or Narada Muni. Not really. I mean, you know, if you have to get cursed in that way, and then you could stand for 100 celestial years, you know, which is not a pleasant experience. Because the trees, they stand there, but they have consciousness, and people carve their initials in them. Like JR and LM. You ever seen that? Little hearts carved in trees? Can you imagine someone carving initials in your body, and you just have to stand there about their love? So the living entity is covered by different degrees. Living entity is covered by different degrees of this lust, and like the mode of passion, ignorance, and goodness. This is really what's happening. Not everybody is in the deepest mode of ignorance. Some people are very high in goodness. But everybody in this world is covered by this lust. in text 39. It was very interesting about lust, how you're never satisfied by it.
Thus, the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire.
So the example Prabhupada gives is you put gasoline or some flammable substance on a fire, it appears to go down for an instant and then it flames up again. So it's really not satisfied. You just got to keep doing it, and then you got to keep doing more. But you see, when people are addicted to different things, whether it's drugs or it's some lusty affairs, they're not they don't think, well, I'm satisfied for the next 10,000 years or next 10 years, whatever it is. They want more and more and more. They have to increase their dosage. And it's an interesting, physiologically it's a fact too, because in the brain there's some pleasure centers. You know, you actually, those who are psychiatrists will understand what I'm talking about. Like the pleasure, anyway, there's certain nerves that go to the pleasure center, and if you could stimulate those nerves, you would experience happiness. So what they did sometimes is they take the monkeys, and basically human beings are just upright monkeys. Or as one person said in the 1960s, naked apes. So there was a book called The Naked Ape. Anyone ever read that book?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what they did with the monkeys is they put little electrodes in the pleasure center and they gave them a button. No need of finding anyone else to enjoy yourself. No need of drugs. No need of alcohol. You just take a little button. I'm not going to press this. But you take a little button and go, wow. And then they kept pressing the button. Anyone who studies psychology has heard about this experiment before. In the university, you hear about this. They kept pressing the button. Wow, ecstatic. They even forgot to eat and drink and do everything else that monkeys normally do, that we do also. So they kept pressing the button. But guess what? They had to keep pressing it more and more and more and more and more to get the same satisfaction. And so that's the problem with lust. You just don't get satisfied. You got to keep increasing it, and it gets more expensive, and you get more headaches. Oh, my God. It's not worth it. And so where is that lust contained? Where is that disease contained? So this is the, you know, we've given the diagnosis and the prognosis. Prognosis is not very good. And the remedial measure. So who wants to read the next text, text 40? So this is where we can see this lust. The senses, that's really easy, isn't it? Like, you know, we're attracted to something, we see something, and we want to accept it, we meditate on it. But then the mind, you know, the mind starts planning out, I want this, I will get that. And then the intelligence also planning long term how to satisfy yourself. So we have to examine the mind intelligence, be introspective enough to see when lust arises in the mind intelligence and mind intelligence and body. That is the senses. So Krishna tells us how to take care of it. Here's the cure. Next text, text 41.
Therefore, O Arjuna, says to the Bharats, in the very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses. And slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization.
So what that means, regulating the senses, is that we understand there's a certain amount of sense gratification we need in an authorized Vedic way, and we take it in a regulated fashion. That means we sleep the same amount every night, we eat, we have a very regulated life. That is one of the main principles of yoga. Yoga is misunderstood nowadays. Generally, when you hear the word yoga, you think of all these different exercises. I was just reading a very interesting article about how the yoga that people practice nowadays with all these different asanas cause people to have bone damage, nerve damage. You know, people try to turn their heads around 180 degrees. They do that. I mean, I got about 20 degrees leeway here. So it looks very impressive, but the hospitals are filled with these yogi, these so-called yogis. There's even one. If there's an article in the New York Times, I sent it to some devotees, and later on, one of my friends, Rita Nandamars, sent it to everybody because he was just very impressed with it. You know, to warn his disciples, don't do it. So the yoga, the interesting thing about yoga, that's not traditional yoga. Patanjali taught one or two postures. That's it, vas. You know, sit, om. That's it. No head between your legs, no pretzel, no bending over backwards, no 180-degree heads. But can you imagine that? You turn your head around. You can unscrew it sometimes, you know. Put it on someone else's body. That would be interesting. Okay. So the modern version with all these extra, even if you have yanger or bianger or whatever, that's not yoga according to the Vedas, to Patanjali. Yoga means to stop the turning of the mind, the vritti, the turning of the mind, and also to meditate on Ishvara, Ishvara Pradanaya, to actually meditate on the supreme control of God. That's yoga. So yoga means to regulate, to live a regulated life, to not eat too much. This is mentioned later on in the Gita. The yogi doesn't eat too much. The yogi doesn't eat too little, sleep too much, sleep too little. But he's very regulated in his sense activity, and he maximizes his time for spiritual activities. It's amazing how much time we have for spiritual activities that we're wasting. You know, so many people come to me, they say, I have to work 8 hours a day. I don't have time for chanting. I don't have time for this. I don't have time for that. I said, all right, what are you doing the rest of the day? I said, let's say you sleep another 8 hours. Okay, 16, right? And then you got 8 hours. What else are you doing during the rest of the 8 hours? You know, you're spending a lot of time. Where's my mobile phone? You're spending a lot of time talking on the mobile phone. How are you? I'm fine. Like that. Such a waste of time. And you're spending time doing so many unnecessary things. You actually have a lot of time for spiritual life if you time management your life. So you regulate your life so you have time for spiritual life, and you strengthen your intelligence. How do you strengthen your intelligence? By hearing about Krishna and the philosophy. You know what is to be done, what is not to be done according to Shastra. If you don't hear regularly, Prabhupada said, you'll go away. You'll deviate from Krishna consciousness. And so so we regulate the senses, and we slay, according to this verse, the great symbol of lust by regulating the senses, and slay the destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. And also in text 42, we're almost finished with the chapter. We're going to finish it today. What does text 42 say?
The working senses are superior to all matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the
mind. So here you have the whole progressive thing here. The soul is higher. Of course, higher than the soul is what? Super soul, Krishna. So you got the soul. Intelligence means the ability to discriminate in a dispassionate way. You got that?
Yeah.
So that means ability to know what's good and what's bad without being influenced by passion or desire or lust. Now, material intelligence that's influenced by passion is the ability to discriminate based on long-term plans. You can give up things, you can give up the desires of the mind and senses based on long-term material plans. I'll give you a practical example of that. Was my father. He wanted to make money. So he was very focused. So he controlled his mind. He got up at 3 o'clock every morning, went to sleep at 11 o'clock at night, was at work at 3 o'clock in the morning. So he gave up sense gratification, gross sense gratification, and the mind's pushing and pulling to get money. And he was successful. And so that's material intelligence. But spiritual intelligence is, you know what is to be done to progress in spiritual life, and you control the mind and senses. You take that as your sankalpa or your goal. So, and then, of course, there's one more text here. Who's going to read the next text, and then we'll finish? Text 43. So, in other words, if we hear regularly about Krishna, because the primary process of Krishna consciousness is Shravanam, right? And then after that comes Kirtanam, and then Vishnu Smaranam, because without Shravanam, you're not going to remember or chant nicely. If you hear regularly about Krishna, at least half hour, an hour a day, that's why it's called Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, then your intelligence will be very strong or strong enough to control the mind and the senses. But that's the most important thing. You hear regularly. Hear means reading, or you listen to your MP3 player with some Krishna conscious philosophy or Krishna katha in some way, and your intelligence will be strong. If you don't exercise your intelligence, it'll be like a flabby muscle. You know what a flabby muscle is? Like if you don't exercise every day, instead of going up, it'll go down. You won't look like Rambo. Because who wants to look like Rambo? Okay, so any questions or comments? We're going to end here. We'll take some questions about whatever we talked about today, Hrishikesh.
I mentioned in one of your thoughts of the day that if one identifies the needs and utilizes the needs
yeah.
of the service of Krishna, then you can be fully dedicated. I wanted to understand more about that.
Well, I'll try to unpack that real quickly. So we all have, as we mentioned before, because we are mostly conditioned souls, we have psychophysical spiritual needs. Not just spiritual, but psycho and physical. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita, he's one of our great acharyas, stated that one has to satisfy all their needs, mental, physical, and spiritual need, in order to be stable in Krishna consciousness. So you have to be able to identify what are those basic needs. A pure devotee doesn't have any physical or material mental needs. But we have needs for friendship. We have needs for air. Like Dhruva Maharaj, he didn't even have need for air, right? He stopped breathing. Can you do that? For more than 3 minutes? No, don't try. We had this competition when I was young. I would go to summer camp. And who can stay underwater the longest? Did anyone ever do that when they were in summer camp? You'd hold on to the counselor's leg. And some of the wonderful things I did when I was young. And whoever could stay the longest won the competition. It's summer camp. You know summer camp. Krishna camp. So, it wasn't Krishna camp. And so, I made it, I think, to 2 minutes, which is pretty good. And some people made it a little longer. But you need air. And one of the other things I did when I was young, I was a scuba diver. Anyone here ever gone scuba diving? No? It's a lot of fun. You put a tank on you, and you go under the water, and you see the little fish eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Doing the same thing people do, but in a more interesting way. Yeah, the fish. Even there was one person, Shobari Muni, was meditating under the water. He saw the fish mating, and he decided he needed to do the same thing. He was agitated by the fish. So, because he had committed an offense to Garuda. So I needed air. That's a basic necessity. I need water. I need food. We need friendship. Social things like that. We don't want to deny our basic human necessities or a need for autonomy. I mean, I can go through a whole thing. There's psychologists who have analyzed it, too. You know, there's one, Maslow, you know, the hierarchy of needs. But the point is that we all have material. And we have mental needs. You know, we need some peace and stuff like that. And then spiritual needs, we need to understand the goal of life. We need to focus our loving attention on Krishna, all these different needs. So when one is able to recognize his needs, and everybody's needs are, let's say the needs are common denominators, but everybody has a different amount of those needs or different strategies for filling those needs. When you're able to identify them and come up with Krishna conscious or strategies that don't conflict with Krishna conscious, then you can be steady in your spiritual life. And that's what I was saying. I mean, everybody has a need to breathe. And fresh air. And peace. And friendship, right? you know, we need friends. Okay. And when you're perfectly Krishna conscious, then Krishna is your buddy. You can just put your arm around Krishna and say, hey, like Arjuna did. Hey, Krishna, how you doing today, pal? But don't try that with the deities, because that that will be an offense, right? How are you doing? Okay, I think we have to end. Also, we wanted to wish Jagat Guru happy birthday. Yay! He's been serving faithfully here in Nugaloka for 55 years. Is that right? And he's like one of the pillars here. I mean, he moves, but he's one of the pillars. And he cooks very nicely, distributes a lot of prasadam all over the area, you know, to people in need, to the universities, the Sunday feast. And he's also expert in computer. He sets up our network, and he's doing all these interesting virtual reality tours of the new temple. And it's enabling us to get support to build the new temple across the street. So we're very happy to have him here, so everybody can wish him a happy birthday. So I guess that's it. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.